particularly thinking of one of our principles, responsible search for truth and meaning, today, the title of the sermon being, What Do We Do With New Truth? Well, what if the new truth says there is no meaning? How do we search for truth and meaning? So that's it's a quandary. And I was thinking, how do we as Unitarian Universalists deal with that? Is that true or is that not true? Who are we as human beings? How do we understand ourselves to be in this world, to be in relationship with one another, to be in relationship to a community and to a larger community in this search for truth? And I think about, if you can think about your own life, we have our worldview, we have our belief systems about us and surrounding us, and within our belief systems, we determine who we're going to be, the shape of our identity, the shape of how we're going to relate to one another. And if you ever had the experience where you feel pretty intact one way or another, and all of a sudden a new truth comes into your world, and it's shattered. If the new truth comes in and it's contradictory to previous beliefs, then you have to rearrange everything you've ever thought before or believed to be true before and put it all back together. And sometimes that can take years, months. Sometimes people don't get put back together at all, and they completely separate themselves from themselves and from others. So this new truth, it's something that's difficult, but yet as Unitarian Universalists, one of our values is to move toward new truth with a sense of responsibility. And some things that I looked at this past week that are pertinent that I thought I'd mention to kind of help set our context that we live in this culture. And one of them was, I was watching, I admit it, Fox News. Just for how they misrepresent the truth. But I was watching this show, and in all seriousness, they were talking to this person from the state of Washington. Apparently, they're having a heat wave, and this was an elderly gentleman who lived in this apartment complex, who had orders from the landlord: do not use your air conditioner. For whatever reason, and this guy saying that he had a problem, he even brought a doctor's note to the landlord saying he needed to use his air conditioner. And Fox News was showing great concern for the elderly. Okay, that's nice. Now, in the evening on Fox News, when they talk about the health care legislation that's being passed, they talk about it in terms and express this idea that if this health care legislation is going to be passed, the elderly will have to choose the way they're going to die, and they're going to be rationed for care. And we know that when there's town meetings and Obama talks, half the conversation is about clearing up the rumors about we're not going to get care to keep us alive, but we're going to have to choose how we're going to die, and he's got to deal with that, and that there's a cruelty to that misrepresentation. So I think this is the world that I live in, the most popular news show, entertainment show, I'm not sure what to call it. But this is the world that I live in, that it is full with these kind of contradictions, and there's a large part of our society that's not thinking critically enough to understand that this is a contradiction. That from the same person, from the same entity, we're getting mixed messages. Have you ever been in a relationship where you got mixed messages? What does that do to our psyche? The classic is, you know, I love you, go away. You know, I love you, but I think whatever it is, it disturbs us. And we have to cope with that. And it causes great dissonance within us. And yet, it seems to me that today, that is part of our worldview, that kind of craziness. Then I saw this piece, and it was about the imagination bringing happiness. And in our spiritual formation class, and if most of you listen to me for a while, you know that the imagination, I think, is where our spirituality happens. It's where our life happens. We have an imaginative field within us, and it either holds our belief systems loosely and yet resiliently, and at the same time flexible enough that we can engage in conversation. And in this particular article, they're talking about belief systems, and it says this: probably everybody knows by now, which I did not know, so probably everybody knows by now that there are 2 million bits of information pouring into our senses every second. And I thought, I know, I'm not dealing with that every second. So something's got, let's say that's true. So something's got to happen. And this person goes on to say that however, our nervous systems and our imagination, the way our imagination works, must set up a filter to deal with that. We must have a filter to deal with that. So that means there are a lot of bits of information that's not coming into my consciousness that exists. Then he says further, he says, one of our protections against data overwhelming us is our belief system structure. Our belief systems filter out information, and that makes us likelier to automatically come to conclusions and come to quick conclusions. For example, if you believe dancing is evil, then you will believe that all dance instructors are also evil because they're promoting evil, and your mind just quickly moves in that direction. You don't critically think about it. That's your belief process, and your belief systems work that way. And that particular article is a good article. It goes on and talks about how belief systems can be like a prison, and they're talking about in the sense of low self-esteem, distrust, and unearned guilt, which is important. They do not make the leap of belief systems are also the structure of our religious belief. They do not make the leap that belief systems are the structure of how we make meaning of the world, and that how we understand our worldview, ourself, and who we are as human beings are wrapped up in a belief system, but yet that belief system is a filter that filters out information, which means sometimes new truth may come to us and we will not necessarily perceive it. We will automatically reject it, or we will not fully gather the meaning of it. There's an example of how belief systems work. One more rigid, one less rigid. If you belong to a book club, or if you come to, sometimes we'll read a book here and say it's a controversial book that's really putting new information into our dialogue, and you have two different people driving to this book club, and one person will be countering all the statements in the book, already figuring out how to argue against all the statements in the book. The other person will be, this is really going to be a good conversation because this is information I didn't know before, and they're not necessarily over and against the new beliefs of the book. They're ready to go in and have a dialogue about the beliefs in the book. When those two people sit down having the same book, they're not going to have an engaging conversation. One's going to be defending the previous belief system. One's going to be able to negotiate whether I should be able to work with this book and whether it would enhance my life, enrich my life or not, rather than defending it with rigidity. We are presently in the process of at least 3 or 4 weeks looking at our belief systems and trying to understand how it is in Unitarian Universalism that theism or that paganism or the atheism, rather than being something that is tolerated and enjoyed among all of Unitarian Universalists, it sometimes causes divisions. So the particular title of this sermon is Beyond Atheism and Beyond Theism, and that they are actually artificial belief constructs that really cause artificial divisions. But yet we live in a world that affirms belief systems and not to change belief systems, or it causes dissonance, which causes us to defend ourselves with more intensity. And I'm suggesting and making an effort to say, wait a minute. If belief systems are a filter, and that indeed we can relax our belief systems, so much so that the way they're held tightly together, we can relax that and information can come in to our belief systems that may enrich our lives, and actually we may be able to let go of our belief systems and reconstruct them on a regular basis, that we might be a kinder and more gentler people to ourselves and to others. And that one thing we talked about, low self-esteem and how that's a prison within belief systems. And as I mentioned last week, how many of us struggle with negative self-beliefs or negative judgments? And we can look at through time and say, well, we've struggled with that all our lives. What would it be like to be without that? What would it be like to be free of that? What would it like to be when I struggle with, I have an anger response which is structured in my belief system that when some stimulus comes at me, I'm automatically angry about it, and I can look over the years and see that's part of who I am. Or, say, if I'm parenting, and I'm struggling with parenting, and I'm having a particularly hard time in life, and my children are just being my children, but yet, at this particular, my belief system and emotional reactivity structured such a way that when they do things, I know I'm overreacting. That's because of how my belief system is. And the stronger and the more intense my emotional reactivity is, the tighter I'm holding on to a belief system. So what we're talking about now is loosening that up so that newness can come in. What we're talking about is letting some of that go and maybe never picking it up again. Because what we're talking about, and we're calling that spiritual formation. And last week, we talked about the religious side of that. This week, we're going to talk a bit about the science side of that. And the next time, we're going to talk about the psychological side of that. This particular aspect of that, the science side of that, and I think when we look at belief systems and when we look at the search for truth and meaning, it's good to take, well, I'm going to look at the religious expression of it, I'm going to look at the scientific expression of it, I'm going to look at the psychological expression of it, so I don't lock myself into a particular discipline. And then I'll integrate it and put them together and try to make sense out of it for myself. So this particular truth, we'll say, knowing it might not be. Now that we're talking about, we can let go of truth, but right now we're going to go with the truth, and it is part of the latest understanding of ourselves as human beings from a neuroscience perspective. Some of these discoveries started in 1995, and they're still working on this. Who are we as human beings? How does our brain work? How does our brain put it together? I can remember about 1988 or 87 was my first real question, and something I've dedicated a lot of my life to is, how is it that from our brain comes this image? How is it that I can close my eyes and I can see a memory from this material object, my brain? How does that happen? And so I've been wrestling with that and working with imagination, and when I was in graduate school, we developed the formation of the imagination and looked at the development of the imagination from infancy, from in the womb on up, and how our sense of self develops and how our sense of self is intertwined with our physical being, and just assuming that our sense of self was our sense of self, that my identity was my identity. So I'm reading fairly recently a couple of things, and one of them was that, you've seen the Discovery Channel or History Channel or something where you look at primates and they got a stick and are using a stick as a tool, and a tool to get food or to do something, and we humans say, well, that's pretty significant. That's human-like as opposed to primate-like. That's pretty significant. Well, the latest brain research says this, that when we use the tool, the brain actually makes the tool part of ourself. The brain will actually say that the tool is part of the self, and it's an extension of the self, and it is not separate from the self. So I think, well, what does that mean? So I can remember being in a bowling league years ago, getting a little ball, you know, and this guy bowled on our team, he always got spares. So we call him the hammer, because he always hammer out spares, right? And so I noticed later on that there was this bowling ball and it had the word on it, hammer. That bowling ball, or we used to call him, got his name, the hammer, and you treated that bowling ball with respect. Because that was his. You didn't pick it up. And if you did pick it up and showed disrespect, you got framed. I can remember one time being on the construction site, framing. We were framing at that particular point. And, you know, framers, tool belts, we had rig axes. This was out in Colorado. And this one particular framer wasn't doing so well and didn't do such a good job. So the superintendent came up to this framer when they were standing on the hill looking at the work, came up to this framer and grabbed the rig axe from his tool belt. My gosh, you'd think the world had ended. It was shame. It was humiliation. You just don't do that. And then he went and told the drywall and said, we got to redo this to do the frame, right? So he was angry. But that rig axe was part of that frame. The objects become part of who we are. Don't talk about my sports team. Don't talk about my car. Don't talk about my shoes. Don't talk about my clothes. Don't talk about my house. We live in a culture where the objects define who we are as human beings. And we didn't fully understand that before, but now we understand it. Our brain says this is part of ourselves. This is part of who we are, this object. Now, I'm reading further, and it talks about our consciousness is actually a tool the human being developed as part of the evolutionary process. That it's a model for what the brain thinks we need to survive. It's not really, in a sense, us at all. So I'm rather read it over that quickly, because all of a sudden, not flag, I think that's significant. Wait a minute, my consciousness is a tool to help me survive? Wait, my consciousness is me. How can me just be a tool, an object for surviving? So I'm trying to find out how this makes sense. And I remember again the Discovery Channel, that great channel, where they had this special on clams and blue crabs. And they said that through evolution, the blue crab would grow a harder claw, and the clam would grow a harder shell, and so we had no daytime, and we had this Cold War going on where they would keep, and that was part of the evolutionary process, that there was an adaptation of these two creatures, these two beings in the world, stronger claw, harder shell, stronger claw, harder shell, stronger claw, harder shell, consciousness. My consciousness is a crab claw? My consciousness is this harder shell? And this particular author is saying, in a way, yes. And I'm going, where is the meaning in that? How am I going to have meaning for who I am as a person if my consciousness is simply crab claw getting harder? And they do get harder. People have been bit or grabbed by a crab claw. You're in trouble. Right? So, anyway, chasing the rabbit. There is a difference with this particular tool. The crab claw doesn't look back at the crab and say, oh, I'm a crab. Oh, what is the meaning of life? But the human consciousness does. It does do something different. So when I discovered this, and in this particular author, he even warns, he says, this does not, he says, a lot of people at this point go to nihilism, say that life is meaningless, and that we can do everything, and I call this the instant people. You read something like that, and you instantly go for what it means, and you drop it, and you let it go, and so they're instant. You know, instant salvation, instant this. If you believe propaganda, which I really have to filter out because I struggle with that, if you believe propaganda instantly and you go on repeating propaganda instantly, you're part of that instant population. I mean, there's a psychological word for that now. It's called, and I shared that before, it's called the normotic personality. The normotic personality of those people who are excessively normal. They look like everybody else, but they're excessively normal. What's that Strong on that show, Little Bitty House, and people running around in the groups? It's the 50s and the 60s that we have become excessively normal. When we become excessively normal, the chief characteristic is no subjective life. To me, that's the grab call. That we are in danger of being the crab claw and the harder shell. We are in danger of not using that human capacity that also evolved to step back and to look at and to reflect and to make meaning. Because the reality is, I do have feelings. The reality is, I am standing here. The reality is, you are sitting there. The reality is, you are thinking about, hopefully, what's being said. The reality is, you're going to do something when you leave here. The reality is, people can say things that will hurt your feelings. The reality is, people can say things that will make you feel good. The reality is, when we look at the larger world, again, the healthcare bill, we think, why do you have to misrepresent it? Just say it like it is and allow the people to vote. If it's what's best, then let's do it. The reality is, there's conflict in that. But if we're excessively normal and we have no subjective life, we don't do that. We will say there is division in belief systems, and our belief system is right. That's what the crab claw does. That's what the clamshell does. We are right. Excessively normal, modest personality. So as Unitarian Universalists, now I've got to deal with this for a moment in time. I'm going to accept this as a truth. That as we evolve, my consciousness is an apparatus. It is a tool for survival. To get along in this world and to try to understand that is very different from my belief system of working with the imagination and how to self-evolve. Now I've got to, from that perspective, I've got to step back and say, I've got some work to do, and it may take me a year, it may take me 2 years, it may take me 6 months, I don't know. And even when I'm done my work of trying to understand what this new truth means, I may even come out exactly the same and say, oh, the people that I have been reading and I have been learning from, very intuitively, they have been right on target all along. Or I might say, look, it's completely wrong, and I have to change everything I do and everything I think, because I don't want to be a person who's incongruent with how my brain works. I don't want to get up here and deliver sermons and conversation and have conversation that's incongruent with how the brain works. I don't want to counsel with couples or counsel with a person and make suggestions this or that when I know deep down it's not how the brain works, and to be incongruent and to foster crap callness, I guess could be a term. I don't want to be about that. And I think as Unitarian Universalists, when we read our principles, we've already made an agreement and a covenant. That's not what we're going to be about. We're going to be other than that. We are going to stop and reflect and make meaning from this scientific perspective about our belief systems. And we can figure out somehow how atheists and how Christian and how Jewish people and how Hindus and how pagans, we can come sit together and say, we have chosen these belief systems because that's what helps us best to operate in this world. And we will be mindful of one another as a result of that. Not critical. Mindful. And we'll be able to ask one another about your belief system. This particular aspect of the belief system seems to me to be helpful, and I'd like to have a conversation about that. Or do I have enough courage to say, this particular aspect of my belief system and how I understand myself has been problematic for me through the years. Maybe it helped me when I was a child. Maybe it helped me when I was an adolescent. But I'm still carrying it, and it's still problematic for me. And I can see that it's a pattern in my life, and I'd like to change this belief system, even though this part of my belief system helped me for a while in my life. I'd like for that to be different. I'd like to have the courage to step back from how I understand myself and the world and evaluate it all and in a way come from that from a non-belief position, so that when I engage the world, I, in a sense, re-choose and choose again how I'm going to be and who I'm going to be in this world. Make a redecision about myself and have the courage to do that. And to me, that is spiritual formation and spiritual life. Having the courage to do that. So here comes this new truth that I have to dismantle my worldview, my spiritual understanding, my theoretical practice of counseling and spiritual, however I'm going to be influential spiritually. And that principle says to do that responsibly. That means I have to step back and dismantle what I have built and then put it back together or not with this new truth. New truths are difficult, even if they're celebrated. Oh, new truth, good. But I have to do something with it responsibly. And as Unitarian Universalists, I think if we look at this from the scientific perspective, from the neuroscientific perspective, we can breathe and say, okay, we can do this. It doesn't mean we have to leave the church. It doesn't mean we have to argue. It means here's something for us to do. Here's something for us to do together. So when we do the spiritual formation classes, and we talk about the detachment wheel, and we talk about the scientific perspective and the psychological perspective, it's not something that pulls us apart. It's something that binds us together, because if I'm reworking my worldview, I'm more vulnerable. Because it means I don't have the answers. It means I'm confused about this. And I need to be in a place where it's okay that I don't have all the answers. I need to be in a place where it's okay to be confused. I need to be in okay. It's okay for me to drop my worldview and say,